Jim Knox is a graduate of Stanford. He earned a master's degree in public policy at the Claremont Graduate School. He has been the executive director of California Common Cause since April 1997, and he does a bang-up job. And the reason I know is that I sit on the board of that state organization. He represents the organization before the legislature, the FPPC, and he's director of Common Cause's advocacy efforts at the state and local level. Before he came to Common Cause, he worked for 9 years at the Planning and Conservation League as its urban affairs director. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Knox.
Thanks, Roy. Well, as Craig said, I was planning on giving you kind of the insider Sacramento scoop on how this came to be, but I understand that Craig's probably already covered that. Maybe we could go into that in some more detail afterwards in questions.
Don't you have a good story that Craig
can
tell us?
Oh, I've got lots of good stories. All right, I'll give a brief before we get into content. It's quite a story. It's important to go back even further where this started, because in 1995, then-Senator Bill Lockyer authored a partial public financing bill in the legislature. That was when the legislature was controlled both houses by Democrats. There was Republican Governor Pete Wilson. The Democrats passed this bill and put it onto Pete Wilson's desk. Wilson vetoed it because he didn't like partial public financing. A few years later, we elected Democratic Governor Gray Davis. So we figured, well, let's dust that bill off and try to run it again, see what happens with the Democratic governor. So John Vasconcelos carried that very same bill 3 years later. Very same bill. What happened? We couldn't even get one vote in committee for that bill. Democrats didn't want any part of it. You know, they didn't want to deal with public financing because for them it was an issue that they didn't want to touch. They didn't want it known that they didn't support it. So they killed it before it even reared its head. And what they did then was they formed a bipartisan study committee within the legislature to look at this issue. That's the crumb we got thrown. And then in Prop 25 earlier this year in 2000, which some of us liked, some of us didn't like, it had some good things, had some bad things, had some public financing, that went down. And then Burton was chastised by Max Pilevsky in one-page advertisements all over the state saying, why did the Democratic Party oppose public financing and campaign finance reform? So apparently that actually struck something of a chord with Burton, and he announced right after Prop 25 lost that he was going to do something about campaign finance reform. He was going to put forward a measure. We called up his office and said, great, you know, we want to work with you. They said, great, we want you to work with us. And so every few weeks or so, we'd call up and say, hey, how's that campaign finance reform bill coming along? They say, well, we're working on it. We really want your input when it's done. And I said, okay. And so then around the 4th of July, we're getting towards the end of the session here, the very last amount of time where you could actually put something on the ballot for November. We hear a Wednesday morning, it was June 30th, that Burton was going to amend a bill in committee, in conference committee. You know, the way the civics class tells you it works in the legislature is that you introduce a bill in one house, it gets heard by a committee, then a fiscal committee, goes to the full floor, then it goes to the next house, gets heard in fiscal committee, policy committee, gets passed by the floor. If it gets passed in a different version than it passed the first house, then it's got to go to something called a conference committee where they work up some sort of a compromise and then they put it back out to the floor. So there was a bill that had gone all the way through this process dealing with slate mailers, and Burton says, well, hey, let's just forget about the slate mailer stuff, and we'll put campaign finance reform in this bill. So this was the first time anyone had heard of this. So it goes to the Ledge Council that night to do the actual wording. Comes out of Ledge Council at 1:30 in the morning, on Thursday morning. 9 o'clock that morning, they have the conference committee meeting to pass this bill, which no one's seen yet until 2 in the morning. There was no testimony allowed at this so-called hearing. The conference committee was made up of the leaders of both houses, the Senate pro tem, Burton, the Assembly Speaker, Hertzberg, the chair of the Senate elections, Murray, vice chair of Assembly elections, Kevin Shelley from San Francisco. They all say, what a wonderful thing campaign finance reform is. We should pass this. Let's get it onto the floor. So they passed it out. The very next working day, it passed the Senate by a vote of something to 2, and went to the Assembly the next day, passed, went to the governor's desk the next day. He signed it. It was the last day that a governor could sign something to put it on the ballot. Now, there was an incredible behind-the-scenes maneuvering, even on the vote, because the way the process works is that when the legislature puts a ballot measure on the ballot, the leaders of both houses get to pick who writes the pro-argument and who writes the con-argument. They pick from someone who voted for it to write the pro-argument, someone who voted against it to write the con-argument. Now, Burton worked very hard behind the scenes to have only one person vote against it because he knew he wanted to write the con-argument. He knew he wanted an ineffective, anti-campaign finance reform argument. And so he had Bill Morrow, conservative Republican, lined up as the only no vote. He got all the Democrats to back off it, save for Tom Hayden, who had the courage to cross leadership and actually vote against it. That obviously annoyed Burton. So technically, Burton has the ability to appoint who's going to write the yes argument and, if you can believe it, the no argument. So he gets to choose the opposing argument. He naturally didn't pick Hayden because he knew that Hayden was going to expose Proposition 34 for what it was. He picked Morrow. And so that's why we got that miserable argument that Craig told you about. And then it permeates the entire system. It goes to Lockyer himself as the Attorney General. If you read in the how many of you have gotten your ballot pamphlets yet? Okay. The only thing worth reading about Proposition 34 is what the legislative analyst writes about it, because that is the only kind of independent, truthful assessment of what Prop 34 does. And you will see in that assessment a lineup, a comparative analysis of what Prop 34 does versus what Prop 208 does, that it repeals. It's the only place in the ballot pamphlet that indicates that Prop 34 does repeal Prop 208. And if you read that as what it does, you have to come to the conclusion that no impartial summary of what Proposition 34 does can ignore the fact that it repeals Proposition 208. Unfortunately, the Attorney General, who writes the title and summary, did not come to that same conclusion. The title and summary is what appears on the ballot. It's what a lot of people read and then read no more. And it says nothing about repealing Proposition 208. And then finally, as I think Craig probably also mentioned, the Secretary of State stuck it to us as well, because in the ballot pamphlet, there's one section toward the front which lists what each measure does, what a yes and no vote is, who to contact for the yes campaign and the no campaign. And that is completely discretionary. The Secretary of State can put in whatever he or she thinks is the most accurate information. So when it comes down to who to contact if you want more information about No 134, the contact is the wife of an assemblyman who co-authored one of the bogus no arguments at a P.O. box in Yucaipa, instead of our committee, California's Against Phony Reform, which is sponsored by Common Cause and the League of Women Voters and AARP, which has a registered committee, unlike this other bogus front, which has an address and a phone number and a website and is out there actually raising money and campaigning. You know, we are the only campaign out there. And yet, if you are the average voter, you want to know how to find out about Proposition 34, you're told to go to a post office box in Yucaipa, and that's it. Absolutely appalling. But so what does it do? Obviously, it repeals 47 of the 60 provisions of Proposition 208. The entire heart and soul of 208 is history. The contribution limits are high, really high. For example, the contribution limits for governor, $20,000 per election. Proposition 208 was $500 or $1,000 if you accepted the spending limits. $20,000, that's 20 times more than the federal limit. 40 times higher than Prop 208 limit. So basically you can give 20 times more to a candidate for governor than you can give to a candidate for the United States presidency or the United States Senate. That's how much sense that makes. But even worse, I think, is that those limits are completely illusory, really, because there are so many loopholes, intentional loopholes, in how this measure was crafted. There is no limit to what individuals can give to parties. There is no limit in what parties can give to candidates. There is even, this is worse than a soft money loophole, because there's hard money loopholes. There's a $25,000 limit to the parties, allegedly, but there are so many loopholes in how you can get around that. For instance, there's a specific exemption for party mailings. So money contributed for a party mailing is not subject to the contribution limits. In other words, if I'm the NRA or Philip Morris, well, let's take it back a step further. I'm a candidate. I'm saying I'm running for governor. I contact the NRA or Philip Morris and say, hey, I could really use $1 million for my campaign. Why don't you write $1 million check to my party mailing fund? You say, okay. Then the candidate goes to the party and says, hey, you're going to get $1 million from the NRA or whoever it is, and I would like these many mailings to go to the party members in my district. This is a camera-ready copy that I want you to produce and mail. Check comes in. The mailings get done completely legal under Proposition 34. So Proposition 34 will do nothing at all to limit the huge special interest money in politics. It will only thing it will do is it will funnel it through the parties. And in some ways, and this gets back to the worse than nothing, in some ways it will actually be worse than what we have now, because it will be even more difficult to track the money. Because we'll know that the $1 million went to the party and the party spent $1 million on this candidate mailing, among all the other money that comes and goes. But we won't know the direct connection. The candidate will know it. The donor will know it. The party will know it. But the press won't be able to prove it, and we citizens and voters are never gonna get that information. So they will talk about the limits in Proposition 34, and you know, not only are the limits too high, but they're completely fictional. There are essentially no limits in Proposition 34. And it's really, it's been entertaining going on the lecture, on the debate circuit, because I've been debating these party attorneys who have been fighting campaign finance reform in the courts for years and years and years. And now they go up and they try to convince people how, you know, we've got nothing on the books now. We really need campaign finance reform. And the reason we have nothing on the books is because these attorneys have been able to hold things up in court. But now that it finally looks like they're going to lose with Proposition 208, they're anxious to get this repealed. I don't know if Craig mentioned the memo, the legislative staff memo.
I did mention that,
too. But, you know, it tears down any veneer that they have of sincere motives to enact campaign finance reform. This consultant, this is what the legislative staff person said, this consultant has polled all three appellate attorneys, Democrat and Republican, handling the Prop 208 case, and they are unanimous in their opinion that Prop 208 will eventually be put back in place by the courts. You know? And they had the nerve to go on radio and TV to say that this has got nothing to do with 208. 208 is never coming back. We really need something to replace it with. In my 20 years as a public interest advocate in California, this is without a doubt the most deceptive and the most dishonest measure I've ever seen on the ballot. And we have our backs are really up against the wall on this one. We're just at a tremendous disadvantage because of what the ballot pamphlet says. I've left some things in the back of the room for you to pick up, some more information about Prop 34, some of the great editorials that we've gotten. And there are bumper stickers back there. Take the bumper stickers. But we really need you to help us get the word out. And that means talking to your friends and neighbors. It means sending out emails. It means talking to your groups, making announcements at your groups. If your groups have newsletters that are coming out in November, get them to write something about Proposition 34. We need money. We need money desperately. If we are not able to get some sort of a media campaign to tell people the truth about Proposition 34, the likelihood of us prevailing in this is very slim, because what most people are going to know is what they read in the ballot pamphlet. And if we can't combat that with some sort of a media campaign, even a modest media campaign, we're really going to be up against it. I suspect that we're going to have, if not every major paper in the state, close to every paper in the state on our side on this, but that's not going to be enough, because more people read the little snips in their ballot pamphlet than read editorials on this. So there are donation envelopes back there. We really could use your help, and we use your help in getting money. I mean, Lord knows how much money there is within a 30-mile radius of this room. And if any of you know people who can write those big checks or can point us to people we can ask to ask those people to write those big checks, that's really, I'm afraid, what we need now. It's an ironic position that we're in, that we've got to raise big money to fight big money. But it's the truth. That's the position we're in. And unless we can generate some support for a media campaign, we're going to be hard-pressed. So with that, I'll turn it back to Roy. Thank you.